Good afternoon. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 16th. I believe today is Fat Tuesday for those maybe celebrating that holiday. We do have a quorum to do business. We are meeting in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy for those committee members and folks here and staff. Committee members present today are Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to do business. Today we are holding two initial hearings on Senate Bill 65 and Senate Bill 70. We will take an overview of each bill, any invited and public testimony, and we'll hold those bills for further consideration. Today we'll begin with Senate Bill 65, a liability consulting healthcare provider with a sponsor, Senator Keel. He is here at the table with his trustee staff. And you may begin when ready, Senator. And we also are joined by Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. My name is Jesse Keel, and I have the privilege of representing Senate District Q, the northern half of the Southeast Panhandle. With me today is C.J. Harrell, who is the Ted Stevens Legislative Intern through the University of Alaska Legislative Internship Program in my office. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, she'll give a brief introduction to the bill.
May we begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is C.J. Harrell. I work for Senator Keel as an intern. Within Alaska and other states, healthcare providers will seek the knowledge and expertise of fellow medical professionals to help them understand how to help their patients in an effective and timely manner. These conversations may be an official consultation, but more often than not, medical professionals will have what are called curbside consultations. This is when a patient's healthcare provider has an uncompensated, informal consultation with another medical professional. These consulting medical professionals are often specialists and do not have any relationship with the patient being discussed. It is a fast and effective way of sharing knowledge and expertise and is the backbone of medical care. It was not until 2 years ago in Minnesota that a healthcare provider who had no relationship to a patient was forced to defend themselves against a civil liability case. We fear that by not protecting those who have no relationship to a patient and are sharing their expertise through a curbside consultation, they will no longer feel comfortable aiding fellow healthcare providers in that way. This bill will allow curbside consultations to continue, but now without the fear of becoming subject to civil liability for a patient who they have no actual relationship to. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, we were joined by Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any questions for Bill's presenter?
Sure.
Senator Begich.
That's my name. Always good to be recognized by the chair. That's how it's these masks. They do it to us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a couple of questions, and I was working with my staff and we've had a good conversation, and of course we went through a lot of these questions last year when the similar bill was before the committee, and I see that most of the changes that were suggested then are incorporated in this version of the bill, which is I think is just a great place to start from. We had talked in my office when you came by a little bit about the telehealth issues, telemedicine issues, and I'm just curious, is this, now that the emergency order we've been under, which has extended telehealth, is gone, does that have any impact on what this bill might or might not do? Is there any relationship to telehealth that I should know about or that you could explore, or have you thought about that at all?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Begich, I don't see a particular hook to telehealth. What we think of as telehealth is generally providing direct patient care. Consulting, if not face-to-face, camera-to-camera with a patient establishes, between the medical provider and the patient, does establish a doctor-patient relationship. There's a duty of care there. When we talk about curbside consults, we very frequently will have one doc on the phone with another or with a pharmacist, but they are not, the consulting doc is not seeing the patient. And when we think of telehealth, I think primarily of someone seeing the patient.
So if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just to really make the point, which is sort of why I asked the question, is we have the curbside consult, we have the doctor that is dealing with the patient, and we have the patient. So really establishing that difference in that relationship, right? Is that correct, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To respond, I think in the three-fist scenario you've laid out for the committee, certainly the treating healthcare professional may seek a consultation, a curbside consult with a colleague. This bill protects that curbside consult. But as long as the consulting physician is not themselves laying hands on the patient, even virtually laying hands on the patient, they would not be liable.
That answers that question. I have one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
Have you given a thought to the cost, the estimated cost to Alaskans if a bill like this weren't provided in terms of liability insurance, those kinds of things? Have you given that a thought, or is that what's driving the bill itself?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. To answer Senator Begich's question, that is one of the key drivers. I think the financial cost would be very difficult to suss out. The potential for increased medical malpractice costs is significant, although I don't have a number for you today. The potential cost to the healthcare system as a whole, I think, is much greater. The potential that a doc who might previously have said, you know, let me call a specialist and see if we need to have you transported. Let me call a specialist and see whether we need to refer you for a workup. When that answer can safely be no, a lot of money is saved compared to that specialist simply not being available. That specialist saying, I'm sorry, I can't do a free consult for you. I need you to send every patient. That's a risk we need to avoid, and that's what Senate Bill 65 helps us prevent.
Thank you. We have Senator Reinbolt, followed by Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so my question, welcome. This is cool to have you actually, because you're coming to my committee next, Judiciary. So I'm going to go ahead and get some things on the record right now. First of all, does this have any protection at all in regards to administering, like, the mRNA vaccine? I just want to get this on the record.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Reinbold, certainly not directly, but I can see the potential implication if a healthcare provider had a patient who was medically fragile or had some complicating medical conditions and wanted to call a specialist and find out whether perhaps those would contraindicate, those would suggest not giving the shot. We would want them to be able to make that call, and this bill would help make that a safe call.
Through the chair?
Yeah, follow.
Through the chair. So I'm going to drill down. So the person who's actually administering the shot, does this protect them in any way, yes or no?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer Senator Reinbold, no. That person lays hands on the patient, and they would retain whatever liability they otherwise had were there an adverse reaction for a bad reason that might cause liability.
Thank you.
So through the chair, do you mind if I drill down on why that question is so important to me?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically, once you do treat the patient, you're pricking the skin, you're injecting something in, and you really don't know the long-term safety, efficacy, or exactly if how the body's going to react to those chemicals. So it's like a car. If a car manufacturer creates a car, and they know that all as they can think of is the dollar signs, you know, the billions, if not trillions of dollars in pharmaceuticals or car sales, if that's all they're looking at, they may not do the safety tests that they need to. They might not pick the best products or the best seatbelts, et cetera. So the same thing with a pharmaceutical company. If they can just know that all they can look at is the profits and how many people that they can inject, they're not going to look at the long-term safety trials, the interactions and things like that. And so because so many people, about 5,000 a day, this is going to be a top, absolutely top issue for me. And that was my first red flag with this bill. I wanted to make sure that there were zero protections for people because, as you know, we've talked about this in judiciary, informed consent. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the indulgence. We have talked about informed consent in detail here. And thank you for everybody's support, not only here, but on the floor. But it is required with emergency youth authorization. There's so many Alaskans, over 100,000 plus the military, that have been impacted. I don't know. I hope to goodness the long-term effects are good, but we don't know what they are. That's why I just want to go with extreme caution for everybody who's actually administering these, does give informed consent during these, and that everybody knows when they take these products that the long-term safety is not established. But I'm very happy to know that there is zero protection for those people in this bill, and I thank you very much for allowing me to explain myself.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Good job so far, CJ. Congratulations on your first bill. I have two separate questions, Mr. Chair, very different. So if do I have your permission to ask both of them? Okay. The first one is, I'm just wondering if this bill could be interpreted in any way to apply to not having two providers in a scenario. In other words, a person who is not a provider has a conversation in a coffee line with a provider, and the provider gives some advice. He hasn't treated the person, hasn't written up a report, hasn't done an exam, but makes a suggestion, and then the patient perhaps has that prescription medicine left from a prior incident and uses that and would have an adverse reaction. Could this relieve that provider of liability? In other words, that scenario would not occur here.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In response to Senator Hughes, no, that scenario would not be touched by Senate Bill 65. Senate Bill 65 covers consultations between health care providers.
Follow-up?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you please show me in the bill where it does that? I'm not doubting you. I just want to know where it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'll take a look at page 1, line 7, you can see that the bill provides the immunity to a consulting health care provider. And then if you'll skip down to page 2 at line 20, you will see that consulting health care provider is defined as a health care provider who provides advice to another health care provider. And we then define that with a list of licensed health care professionals in the state.
Okay, perfect. I appreciate that. Now my second question, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Okay, my second question, and my intern had a conversation with your intern, Senator Keel, and I thought it was a good point, so I just wanted to ask you, on page 2, line 14, beginning with number 9, a written report is not prepared as a result of the consultation. Now, so your consulting health care provider gives some advice to another provider in the coffee line, and that provider prepares a report and then acts on it and treats the patient accordingly. There's an adverse reaction, and then the patient sues. Because that intermediary provider wrote something up, could that be interpreted to be a written report was prepared, or should we be specifying here that the written report must be created by the consulting provider?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Senator Hughes, I don't know that clarification would be in any way harmful. That certainly matches the intent, because the liability shield is provided to the consulting provider. I don't think it is strictly necessary. In the scenario you described, if I understood you correctly, the treating provider would be the one who did the writing there. Their liability rests with the treatment they provided. It's irrespective of the report. And I don't think the report would provide them a loophole, but I see no harm in that clarification.
And can I follow up with
yes,
that? And I don't want to imply that healthcare providers are nefarious in any way, but I could see if I were a provider and I took some informal advice in the coffee line and there was an adverse result and that patient I knew was coming after me, and if I could create a report that says I received this advice from another physician to help spread the burden of liability, I could actually see where it might be necessary to clarify that this written report would be a written report by the consulting provider, just to prevent that kind of situation. Even though it would be rather unlikely, it still could occur.
Thank you.
And would you entertain that, I guess, as a friendly amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to that clarification.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, any other questions for the bill sponsor at this time? If not, we will open up for folks for invited testimony. We have a few folks here, I believe three. First, we'll move to Dr. Jacob Kelly from the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute.
Hello, Jacob Kelly. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir. If you want to put your name on the record and you may begin with your invited testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Jacob Kelly, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 65. Hopefully that's enough information for me. I definitely support this bill. I think it allows us to provide unencumbered clinical expertise to help patients all across Alaska, which is according to our kind of Alaska Heart and Value kind of mission, which is to take care of all of Alaskans in Alaska, regardless of location, ability to pay, so that we can improve their care. I think this will allow us to provide better local care. I think this will lead to decreased transfers, or I should say decreased inappropriate transfers, or not necessarily inappropriate, but allowing patients to be cared for locally where they are, hopefully more safely. And I think ultimately it would reduce costs. So I think from a provider's perspective, on a given night and call, I would get anywhere from 2 to 10 calls from 10 different potential cities, from nurse practitioners, from emergency room physicians, from family physicians, from other specialists. And it's really nice to just be able to support them in their decision-making and their thought process without being concerned about any kind of litigation when I have no access to the patient's records or data. Even in a given day in clinic, when I'm just seeing, 15 or 20 patients, I'll get 1 to 2 calls because as a heart failure specialist, people have questions about how to titrate medications. And sometimes that's difficult to kind of transfer in to be seen in Anchorage for an expensive visit when maybe a slight titration of medications would ultimately lead to improved survival and improved quality of life. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this Senate bill. And I'm also happy to answer any specific questions to help folks understand what it's like to care for this wonderful population across a diverse landscape.
Any questions for this invited testifier? Yes, Senator Hughes and Senator Reinbold.
Yes, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to testify. And I know how important it is to have sharing of knowledge among experts in the field. And if we were not to pass this, I was concerned. I talked to the sponsor about this. I certainly, now that there is a precedent that a consulting provider has been sued in another state, I would be concerned that it might inhibit good conversations and knowledge sharing between providers. Could you, if this were not to pass, do you think that it might inhibit knowledge sharing that could be helpful to Alaskans?
Am I allowed to respond?
Yes, if you would like to, please do.
I mean, I would hate to say that, but yes, I would agree this would probably make us more reticent in answering specific questions, and things would have to be even more general, and I really think I would be much more likely to just have a patient on a transportation into Anchorage to one of the larger hospitals to provide potentially, care that could have been delivered locally.
Thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
Okay, thank you, Chair Wilson. So basically what I was going to ask, do you see this potentially reducing your malpractice insurance at all? That would be my first question.
I may leave that to our CEO, Robert Craig. I do know that the main MEIC is our main insurer in Alaska for most physicians, and they are very much in support of this bill. But I don't know that we'll see a direct cost reduction, but I don't want to misspeak. I think we just all see it as allowing us to provide higher quality of care with less, less blinders or restrictors on. But I'll defer to Robert Craig if he has any other specific information on that. That honestly is not influence on our interest in this, to be honest. It's really just about feeling comfortable being able to provide care without, being pursued for – because we never would want an adverse event. I just want people to be able to get the best care they can. Because I may be one of those folks out in the remote areas and needing that help from a specialist, because we all like to travel to these wonderful places.
Mr. Chairman, is he online?
Yes. And Sandra, yes. He's next up to testify.
I see. Oh, okay. I did not realize that. So I'll hold my question.
Okay. See no further questions for Dr. Kelly. Thank you for your time. Next up to give public testimony, and if you could answer the question too, Robert Craig from the CEO of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. Mr. Craig, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, if you want to provide your testimony, and then if you want to answer Senator Reinbold's question, please do so.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just for the record, my name is Robert Craig, and I'm the CEO for Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 65. Mr. Chairman, in answer to the Senator's question, I don't anticipate that there would be any change to our malpractice premiums. To be honest, we haven't even really checked to see. As Dr. Kelly stated, it wasn't part of our motivation and support of this bill, but I don't anticipate there to be any change in malpractice premiums at all as a result.
Do you want to continue with your testimony?
Certainly. So by way of background, as Dr. Kelly stated, our cardiologists are on call and available effectively for the state 24/7. And that coverage, just to be clear, is not part of an EMTALA obligation. They're not a patient of ours. We're not reimbursed for that call. Our physician that may be in Anchorage could take a call at any time of the day or night, for example, from a Juneau physician who has a cardiology-related question or a test to help interpret in that treating physician's care for a patient. So since we don't have a patient record and we may be unfamiliar with the patient in question, it places a special burden on our doctor to be open to potential civil liability in a particular instance. But our physicians are primarily interested, as Dr. Kelly eloquently stated, in giving timely and accurate information to another treating physician's call. And as he stated, the option to this is, we could advise the treating physician to send the patient to Anchorage or make a formal request by way of a consultation, which the obvious downside there would be to either delay care and or increase healthcare costs to patients. So the goal of our providers is to continue to provide, obviously, a very high level of cardiology-related service to the state's providers calling for that service in a high-quality and low-cost manner.
All right. Follow-up, Senator Rambo?
Through the chair, just to get it on record, thank you for that information. But just to take note, at a future time when this bill does come before judiciary, I'm probably going to get a lawyer that represents patients and a lawyer that represents practitioners, and also the insurance company that ends up covering a lot of the doctors to really vet this out, because I don't want any unintended consequences. Of course, we want to be able to protect the kind-hearted Samaritan doctors that we all probably talk to on a street corner, which I do believe they, out of the kindness of their heart, they're helping us. So, of course, that's what. But I just don't want the unintended consequences. So with that, I just want to tell him thank you that he did clear the air somewhat. But I sure wish malpractice insurance would go down at some point in time. It's like no matter what we do, it seems like the insurance companies just make out like a bandit. And so I'm just trying to figure out how we can get insurance premiums and malpractice down as well. So that'll definitely be a question I ask MEIT when they come before our committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Craig? Thank you for your time, Mr. Craig. Next for invited testimony, we have Dr. Stephen Compton from the Alaska State Medical Association.
Good afternoon, everyone. And so Stephen Compton with the Alaska State Medical Association. And full disclosure, I'm another cardiologist with Alaska Heart, but I'm wearing the ASMA hat for today. From the heart standpoint, we estimate we're doing 10 to 20 curbside consults a day. We get phone calls during the day from all around the state. We get calls from every emergency room in the state, every little clinic and villages, you name it. And some of them are urgencies and emergencies. Some of them are not so bad. And you can imagine all the different outcomes. And sometimes we'll get a call where the referring doc is super worried and we can calm them down. And sometimes it's just the opposite where, oh, this is a big deal and that patient needs to come in right away. And much of the time, these are just problems that we can help them manage locally. And Alaska has a greater need for this sort of referral network and informal consultation. We have a greater need than any other state because of our size. You know, unintended consequence, I guess, of just being such a spread out place is that there are healthcare inequities. And if you live in a village on the Yukon, you just don't have the same access to care that you might if you lived in a big city. And so, but we do have excellent telecommunications and we have this excellent communication network, and we can certainly provide expert opinions to every last corner of the state. We were alarmed, and that's what we've been doing. I've been practicing in Alaska for 20 years, and we do this for free, and we take these calls at 2 in the morning, and we do it for free. It's just part of what we do, and we see that as part of our duty to the citizens of the state. And so so you can imagine our alarm. About a year and a half ago, our insurer came, and they requested to speak at one of our partner meetings. And they reviewed the Minnesota case that Senator Keel alluded to and a few other cases that were pending at the time, and said, listen, this is going to be a problem. And if this doesn't get nipped in the bud, we anticipate the potential increase in rates. That was part of it. But mostly we need to talk about your habits regarding curbside consults. And they said, well, here's what you can do for a curbside consult. You could give very general ideas about how to manage a general case, but if there's anything specific about a case management, well, then according to what happened in Minnesota, you would potentially be liable for anything that happens with a case. And so our insurers are telling us, well, you should either not do these, you should have them all fly in to Anchorage so you can see them in person, or you should address this in a legislative way. And so that's kind of why we're here. And speaking for the Alaska State Medical Association, it's just not just a cardiology issue. This is a problem if you're an allergist, if you're an ENT doc or a urologist, you name it. Every specialty is getting these calls from all around the state. We all do this, and we all think that it's an important service to provide. And I hadn't appreciated until this conversation with our insurer that this is really kind of the lubrication for this whole machine. And it helps us avoid inappropriate costs, and it helps us provide excellent care in remote places that where people would never get the same level of attention. So the ASMA very strongly supports this bill, and I really appreciate the group of you taking the time to consider it.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Compton?
Can I make a comment? Is that a
yes,
comment?
Senator Reinbold.
Okay. I can't help myself, Dr. Steve Compton. I just want to say thank you for coming on today. You know, I have tremendous respect for you being in pharmaceuticals and selling heart products and actually helping put a lipid clinic in your facility. But I also just wanted to say thank you. Your testimony is very powerful with me. And I also wanted to say congratulations. It looks like Gus grew up to be a great skier, making national junior nationals with wonderful cross-country skier just like his dad. It's a pleasure to be at East High with you and being on your team many years ago. Thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Oh, and thanks for the shout-out.
Yes, Senator Begich.
And, Mr. Chairman, I want to once again point out a point of agreement between myself and Senator Reinbold. Steve Compton, as somebody I've known for years and is just totally respect his opinion, and hearing him today on this call makes a big difference to me as well.
Thank you. All right, seeing no further questions for Dr. Compton, thank you for being here and providing your invited testimony. We'll now open up to public testimony. Does anyone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify to Senate Bill 65? All right, seeing none, anyone else online to testify on Senate Bill 65? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? Bill sponsor, want to make any closing comments for today? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside, and we'll take an at ease as we prepare for Senate Bill 70. Thank you. All right. We are back on the record. We are now going to take up Senate Bill 70, the opioid overdose drug, sponsored by my office, Senator Wilson. Today we'll provide an overview of the bill and invite our trustee staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin, also known as – all right. we'll take invited testimony as well, open up public testimony, and we'll set the bill aside, too, for further consideration by the committee is the intent today. Just to give a quick overview of the bill before Ms. Martin goes over the sectional, this bill actually started off as a disaster declaration by former Governor Bill Walker. I think it was a Senate Bill 91, which was passed into act in 2017. And the intent was to allow the medical officer at that time was Dr. Jay Butler, to allow their office to allow naloxone to be administered under a federal grant. And the grant was going to last for 4 years, so we made the amendment here in this committee to extend the declaration for those 4 years to allow for the federal funding and allow the chief medical officer that standing declaration. Our understanding, which the department will go into during their invited testimony, is to explain that they still have federal funding to administer this bill, to administer this program, and thus that's what Senate Bill 70 does. Naloxone is not a controlled substance. It has no potential for abuse. This legislation, again, benefits Alaskan by saving lives. It translates to direct savings to emergency services, law enforcement, and it gives those that may overdose a greater chance of living and gives them the opportunity to get into treatment. Without this life-saving legislation, benefits of many friends, family members who would normally die of an overdose without this life-saving medication. And with that, we'll let Ms. Martin go over the sectional.
Yeah, as Senator Wilson noted, Senate Bill 91 from 2017 is in your packet. For the record, my name is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. And so Section 1 of the bill amends AS 1720.085C and repeals language regarding the sunset of the original authorization. So this is actually conforming to Section 3. Section 2 repeals AS 1720.085D, which was a reporting requirement for the department for the related to the opioid epidemic and these grants. Section 3 repeals Section 2, Chapter 1, Session Law 2017, which was the actual sunset date of the original authorization, and Section 4 is an immediate effective date. And if I don't know if there's any questions, or Senator Wilson?
Yes, Senator Baggage.
I actually have a series of questions about each of the sections you just went through.
Perfect.
You talk about repealing the report, and part of the value of the report process was for us to know where we were when it came to, you know, the opioid epidemic situation. So why are we repealing the reporting requirement when there's already a process in place, and why would we need to repeal it?
Sure. Thank you for that question. So reports take up a lot of the department's time. This information will still be available to the legislature if we request it. I think it made a lot of sense to have this reporting requirement when this was more of a pilot program and something that was new, but as it's continuing into perpetuity, the idea was not to make the department report year after year into perpetuity, taking up department resources.
And Senator Baggage, I actually put that reporting requirement in the initial bill, and my haste to do so and rushing this through the process, I did not put an end date on that report. So if this were the program were to end in June, they would still have to report by law to the to the legislature. So I just didn't want to continue them having to do a report, even if the federal funds end or something else, because the report was just on the federal funding of the program.
That brings me, Mr. Chairman, to my follow-up question,
yes,
which is this also repeals the sunset clause. So that would imply that the program would be continuing on an annualized basis. So why would you then need to repeal the reporting process if you're going to continue the program on an annualized basis? That's what I'm confused by, and that's why that's the nature of my two questions.
Senator Baggage, so the intent was basically, as Ms. Martin stated, is that the department has a lot of reports that for programs that they don't technically do by law, and I just didn't want to add additional report if the legislature for programs that may eventually sunset or continue on, because I don't plan to be in this job forever. And so I won't be here to say, hey, we stopped that program a long time ago. We don't need to do that report. And not many legislators do a review on the number of reports the department has to do. And there is about, I would say, almost 24 reports that are no longer relevant that we our office took a look at, and we just didn't want to have one more report. But if the report is recommended, we can definitely put a report requirement back in here as an amendment.
What I'm getting at is the sunset law, though. So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the follow-up, what I'm just trying to get a handle on is either we're eliminating the sunset clause, which means this program becomes perpetual, in which case there's a separate argument to be made as to whether or not there should be a report, and we can have that discussion, or we're getting rid of the report requirement because you don't want to have a report required for a program that might sunset, but we're eliminating the sunset clause. So which is it? That's all I'm trying to get to. Is that I was here for that debate and that discussion. I supported the bill at the time. I supported the report requirement, as you may recall, at the time. And if we're going to just eliminate the sunset clause so this becomes a standing order in perpetuity, which I'm actually okay with, because of the nature that was described 4 years ago when we talked about the rapidly changing natures of these various drugs that changes so fast, as then Chief Medical Officer Butler said, changes so fast we don't have the time to respond with a new authorized scheduled drug approach to it. If we're going to repeal that clause, I would just suggest you would want to keep the report process viable until such time as we either no longer are getting federal resources, because otherwise how do we keep track on a regular basis? Surely we can always call the department if we want to, but I think what I'm trying to get at here is I don't think you need Section 2 if you're going to do Section 3. I think you have to continue to have reports. If you're going to repeal the sunset clause, you ought to continue to have reports. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yes. I was just going to note that this bill doesn't necessarily create a program. It allows the chief medical officer to issue the standing order, but it doesn't require that they issue the standing order. And there is programs associated with it, but it's not in and of itself creating a program. I just wanted to provide that clarity.
Just one last follow-up, and then I'll stop.
Senator,
I swear. The reason we had the reports is because we wanted to know when that authority was exercised, because we're not aware of everything happening around us all the time. And maybe it would be only one senator or one House member who would look, but that's the main reason. So, I'm going to support the bill. I just want to be sure we're doing the right thing in how we structure it. That's all.
Question, Senator Reinbold.
It's through the chair. It's unbelievable how many times you and I agree on different things. Being from genuinely different perspectives, but I have to give you a little poke. I voted with your caucus, and you voted with mine last Friday. That was quite an interesting event that happened on Friday. But what my question in regard to this bill, that's exactly what my question was, and I wasn't even going to echo what Senator Begich was saying, but it because opioid use is such a huge deal, and there's so much money that goes into the rehab, and I guess with resources becoming so much tighter, I want to make sure that wherever we're spending money on rehabilitation, that we know the different, we know the impacts of that dollar, because dollars are becoming so much more scarce. And some people say that a lot of wasteful money gets spent. So I'm not sure, how to word it or what in particular. I know this bill only has one committee of referral, and that's why I don't want to rush it. Just like Senate Bill 14, I've had in my committee for a month now. It's painful having the only committee, bill referral. But I do think that question really needs to be answered. If this report is not necessary, I guess put you guys on the defense. Why is it not necessary anymore?
Well, like I said, it was something that I threw in there just to follow the sort of the federal funding of the new program to see the department has those reports, I believe, in your we're going to review those reports. And at the end, if we still, as a committee, would still like to see those reports to continue in perpetuity, then by all means, I'm open to continuing those reports. I just, like I said, it was something that they would track, and I'll let the department speak on their for themselves in terms of the ease or the time that they would like to do this report, the reporting process. Senator Costello.
Is the report an online electronic report, or is it printed?
And we'll go to the, and maybe Ms. Welton, are you online with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Teresa Welton.
If you could put yourself on the record, and I think you're probably the best one to answer that question that we have online.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have the reports online in the website for the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, and as well as we provide them to the legislature by October 1st of every year.
And Ms. Welton, who are you and where do you work?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Teresa Welton. I'm the Chief of the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention with the Division of Public Health.
All right, thank you. And we have a follow-up from Senator Costello. Senator?
Thank you. It wasn't clear from your answer. Is the report you provide to the legislature a printed report or online? Is it electronic?
Thank you for the question. It is both.
Mr. Chair, could we, if we do keep the report, could we just please have it an online report so that we're not printing a report that sits on a shelf that you could search online for?
Senator Reinbold.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And once again, I'm going to echo Senator Begich's comments in regards to this. I just looked at the fiscal note. There's no fiscal impact. I was like going to be more motivated to take it out if there was a fiscal impact, but there's no fiscal impact. So I'm leaning toward keeping it, and I certainly agree with Senator Costello that, you know, I think online is fine. I know that this issue is in, I have Highland Correctional in my district, and this medication is very important, and it has saved lives, I believe. And so I think sometimes just having that information, just being able to say, hey, we're doing some things right, I think it actually could be a place to toot horns of some things that we're actually doing right. So with that, I'm gonna urge either an amendment or a committee substitute. This is a tiny little bill to keep the reporting. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Not a problem. All right. Any other further questions for the bill sponsor's office? All right. Seeing none, we will go on to an invited testimony from Ms. Welton, the section chief of the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, also known as OSMAP. And we do have someone here, Ms. Welton, to advance your slides. So if you just want to tell us what slides you're on as you're going through.
Thank you. Slide one, please. For the record, my name is Teresa Welton, Chief of Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, otherwise known as OSMAP, with the Division of Public Health. And I'm presenting on the importance of removing the sunset clause, which is June 30th, 2021. To allow for perpetual authorization of the standing medical order for distribution and administration of naloxone, an opiate overdose reversal drug, by any Alaskan. Slide two, please. An overdose only takes minutes to happen. If naloxone is not readily available to the individual or individuals around that person, they would have the potential to have to wait up to 20 minutes for EMS to arrive with naloxone, and it could be too late. Next slide, please. These are the national trends of opiate overdose drugs that we are tracking as well for Alaska. And you can see that the overdoses are increasing significantly, especially by synthetic opiates such as tramadol and fentanyl. Next slide, please. Too many Alaskans have lost their lives to overdose, even though it is preventable with timely administration of naloxone. In Alaska, overdoses were one of the top 10 leading causes of death in 2017, having killed more people than diabetes, chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, and homicide. Overdose can cause significant medical impact in a person when that person does not receive timely administration of naloxone. It takes just 3 minutes for someone who overdoses to experience brain damage, a costly and lifelong diagnosis. And yet it takes 3 to 4 minutes for paramedics to arrive on a scene in Anchorage. At times within 8 minutes of an overdose, one will die. However, in rural areas, it can take at least 10 to 20 minutes and generally much longer for first responders to appear on the scene. People who survive overdose with brain injury may also have resulting kidney failure, heart complications, neurological consequences, and more. Next slide, please. In the U.S. and Alaska, synthetic opiates, primarily illicitly manufactured fentanyl, appear to be the primary driver of the increases in overdose deaths, increasing 38.4% from the 12-month period leading up to June 2019 compared with the 12-month period leading up to May 2020. While overdose numbers for 2020 through September appear to outweigh 2019, marking the highest overdose death rate in more than a decade in Alaska next to 2017.
Ms. Walton, if you could wait here on the slide. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Walton, why is there an asterisk after 2019? I'm just curious. Do you see where it's opioid overdose death rates dash Alaska, comma, 215-219 asterisk?
Thank you, Senator. I am reviewing it right now. I think that was because of lack of dating in the final quarter of 2019.
So the number could actually be higher than the number that's there, is that right?
Absolutely, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, please continue.
42 states in the District of Columbia have enacted naloxone standing orders. The World Health Organization, the U.S. Surgeon General, and the American Society of Addiction Medicine have officially recommended naloxone be accessible to those who are closest to the person using opiates. Next slide, please. Currently, the standing medical order allows naloxone to be dispensed to any individuals who are not prescribers, a practice that would be prohibited. Naloxone is not a controlled substance, has no potential for abuse, and is safe to use. By removing the sunset date, local and regional overdose response programs, first responders, and the Departments of Public Safety and Corrections and the general public will continue to have the ability to directly distribute and use the life-saving drug naloxone. Next slide, please. With the foundation of this standing order in 2017, the department was able to form the program Project HOPE, Harm Reduction Overdose Prevention and Education. Project HOPE works with community organizations to distribute or administer Narcan, otherwise known as naloxone, in Alaska. Since inception, 127 community partners have distributed over 41,000 fully federally funded Narcan kits. Of the 330 documented Narcan-naloxone administrations originating from Project HOPE, the overdose reversal drug has reversed overdoses at least 309 times. It is believed by Alaskan subject matter experts that when there was a 28% decrease in overdose deaths in 2018 compared to 2017, it is largely the result of a maximum distribution of naloxone for laypersons to use by Project Hope across Alaska. Next slide. Timely administration of naloxone provides the opportunity for recovery, and saving lives saves costs. According to the Society of Actuaries, 40% of the economic burden of the opiate crisis is driven by lost lifetime earnings for those who died prematurely. Nearly 33% is for excess healthcare spendings, another 15% are from lost productivity in the workforce, and 6% are from costs associated with criminal justice. An estimated 29% of the economic burden is borne by federal, state, and local governments. Next slide, please. Currently, the standing medical order allows naloxone to be dispensed by any individuals who are not prescribers. And by removing the sunset date, local and regional overdose response programs, first responders, and the Departments of Public Safety and Corrections and the general public will continue to have the ability to directly distribute the life-saving drug naloxone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for your consideration of Senate Bill 70. Without passage of this bill, naloxone would only be available to those with a prescription from a medical provider submitted to a pharmacy or by EMS. This is why it is imperative to continue to make naloxone widely available to save many lives that would be lost to overdose. I welcome any questions or need for clarifications.
Any questions? Senator Reinbold.
I think, Ms. Sherman. So this bill definitely sounds like it's like a good idea, so don't take my questions wrong, please. I tend to like to ask difficult questions, and it's kind of tough love right now. One, I want to ask, how much does each kit cost? And it sounds like 100% of the costs are picked up by federal and state and nothing by the patient that is benefiting. I mean, just is that do I have that correct?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, complete costs for the naloxone kits is borne by federally funded grants. So at this point, the approximate cost of a kit which contains two doses of naloxone, and additional education and harm reduction efforts, and information for connection to treatment, each kit costs approximately less than $4. There is no cost to the user or the distributors. And like I said, we have this program, Project Hope, that has been fully funded for both the substance of the naloxone itself, as well as the program coordinator position that then coordinates with our regional distributions to get the kits out to users. So we have full funding still for the next 2 years for Project Hope. There's no state funds being used for the naloxone kits, as well as we are applying for another federal grant that will fund it for another 5 years completely.
Senator Ramble, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, again, I don't mean to sound harsh, but, you know, it almost just seems to me like if someone has the money to go buy, you know, opiates or, you know, synthetic opiates, it just seems like they should have $4 to be able to pay back this for this kit. So I just, not that I don't think these are important and that they save lives and all that kind of stuff, but I am just a huge believer for independent and, you know, responsibility and teaching people responsibility. So at some point I'd like to work on this being user paid, not government paid, because it also does concern me. We also don't want to encourage the use because there's this piece of, you know, that there's this drug that can neutralize the impacts. We don't want to encourage the use of these. So I do think this program needs to be evaluated and looked at and maybe restructured, because I just still don't want to in any way give people false hope to use these just because there's a bailout drug. So with that, thank you for letting me put my comments on record.
Thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to throw a comment out there. I really appreciate this program and those who administer it. And I just wanted to put on the record that sometimes when something sunsets, it gives an opportunity for the legislature to learn about it. And, you know, as the years go on, there will be, you know, different people elected. And I just wanted to throw that out there, that sometimes sunsetting a program just allows us the opportunity to look at it, get a hearing on it, and by putting it in permanent statute, we won't have that opportunity to have these presentations and what have you. So I just wanted to throw that out there and then also say that, you know, I do think the report then is helpful, but it doesn't replace a hearing and testimony and public testimony and the learning that happens for the public when we have a legislation before us at sunsets. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, apologies for having to step away for a moment. Three questions. The first one is, if you could comment online whether or not the experience of naltrexone is a pleasant one, because I'm pretty sure it's not very pleasant.
Thank you, Mr. the Chair, Senator Begich. It is not a pleasant experience when somebody is administered naloxone when they're in an overdose state. It's the biochemistry is that it blocks the opiates to the receptors, so the quote-unquote high and the subsequent medical cascade of an overdose is stopped in its track. They do have a tendency to wake up fairly angry, confused, with an intense headache and potential other medical conditions. However, they wake up alive. And that gives them an opportunity to then get into recovery, because if you're dead, excuse me, you can't go into recovery.
Yes, Senator Begich.
So, Mr. Chairman, just the reason I mentioned that is because I think it was an issue that when we were getting the presentation from CMO Butler, he actually used the receptor example. He gave us it was a slideshow that showed how the receptors worked. I believe that's where it was, or it may have been a lunch and learn, but regardless, it underscored it's actually a very unpleasant experience. So I'm hopeful that Senator Reinbold won't have to have people feeling good about it, because I don't think they do feel good about it, about, you know, that people would see this as an easier process, though I recognize and acknowledge that at some point people have to pay the price for these kinds of things. And so, but the second thing I had was on the report, it's very lengthy. And I don't know if the law spelled out the length and quality and criteria of that report. I'm not certain it would need to be that lengthy to still report to us on what's going on and how the goals are being met. So I would just offer that as a thought. And then the third is a question, which is, we have before us an EO relating to the departmental split that's coming up, and I'm just wondering if that split has any impact on this particular bill, or would it have any impact on this bill? And I don't truly know the answer to that question.
I guess that's the,
yes.
Ms. Walton, I guess the question would be, would OSMAP still stay in the split? Would he go into, stay in the Department of Health, or would you move to the Department of Family Services and Child Services, I think?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The answer to that question is we would be falling under the new Department of Health. There would be no impact upon OSMAP or upon Project Hope continuing.
That's the question of the chief medical officer being placed within the supervisory role. That's what I was trying to get at there. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
So through the chair, I basically, I just been a huge believer that people need to take responsibility for what they do, and $4 just doesn't seem like that much. So that's basically where I was going. I wasn't actually talking about, you know, the overdoses and how miserable that would be, and a hopeful drug that helps bring people out of it. I'm sure it's all not a very fun, pleasant experience. My point is just individual responsibility and not encourage. We have an opioid crisis, for God's sake. We've got to try to curb it and not just say, here's a lifesaver. Do you understand? Okay, so with that, I have a question. And so the 2020 numbers, I'm not sure if you can answer this question or not, but especially post-lockdown, a lot of people lost jobs. They were non-essential. Kids were out of school. There's a mental health crisis with our children right now. I know kids can't get into counseling in many areas right now. The nonprofits are completely tapped out in that are dealing with suicide, drug overdose, child abuse, et cetera. I've just been dealing with one too many burden at a time, and I think that's why I'm so thankful that the governor, and I'm actually going to say something positive right now, did not extend the disaster declaration just because of the weighing mental health concerns with the thought of a disaster, an emergency hanging over people's heads. I am deeply grateful that that did not get extended. So what I want to ask you is in 2020, starting with March, since COVID lockdowns and all the kind of crazy COVID stuff that happened, have you seen an increase in the use of overdoses, for one, and number two, Narcan, naloxone?
Thank you, through the chairman, Senator Reinbold. We have seen an uptick in overdose deaths in the first three quarters of 2020 from 2019 and definitely from 2018 in comparison. And we, due to the COVID circumstances, this past year has been challenging in getting more of the kits built because we rely on volunteer groups to build out the kits, and with social distancing and unable to gather in groups, we've had to adjust how it works to continue getting the kits put together. The distribution of naloxone / Narcan has also been challenged, with most of our partners that distribute the kits have had to change hours, have had to go virtually for some of their consulting and exchange programs. So it could be a cause in relation to there's not as much naloxone or Narcan being distributed in 2020. And it can also be a circumstance of increased mental health complications as well as substance misuse. Those numbers are continuing to be reviewed and looking for causation.
One more question.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so I am trying in my office with the little time I have to actually go in back and do research, because I'm in committees all the time, but I'm trying to look at the differences between the lockdowns and the non-lockdowns, both on a local level in Alaska, on a regional, on a state, and on the whole United States, for the areas that were locked down versus non-lockdown, and finding some pretty remarkable information. It really is amazing, and I can't wait to talk about that someday. But the deaths, I've heard suicide is up. I'm still having a hard time finding those numbers. But I want to know how significant the number of increase of death, because obviously the death has increased. The overdose was increased as well. Do you have any type of numbers or in regards to overdoses, the increase over 2018 or 19 in regards to 2020, or is that something you're not comfortable providing at this time?
Although we're trying to make sure these numbers are correct, for the first three quarters of 2018, I only have approximate numbers right now because this is a bar chart that doesn't show me exactly. There was approximately 70 overdose deaths in 2018 for the first three quarters. There are approximately 100 in 2019, first three quarters, and this 2020 Looks like it's a little over 100 for the first three quarters. But like I said, I'm not super comfortable with that, understanding the causation, whether it is because of the lockdown or the availability of the naloxone, or if our numbers are just going up.
Senator Rumble?
Yeah, just, Mr. Chairman, when they have the opportunity, in particular, I'm very interested in the children. I have really tried to find a lot of information out in regards to this, but when there's actual numbers for overdoses, how much naloxone, you know, helped protect and save lives, and then any statewide, basically, I would like from March 2020, when it's available, you know, that section instead of just the first quarter, because the first quarter there was no lockdowns. I just really want to know the impacts of the lockdowns and keeping kids out of school. I know the parents are going through a mental health crisis, many of them as well, with all the stresses of job losses and kids being home and not being able to get out and go on vacation, and I could go on and on and on. But the bottom line is I really, really want to study. This is going to be an excellent model to study so we can help stop this from ever happening again. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right, with that, we'll now open it up for public testimony. Thank you, Ms. Walton, for being online. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau like to testify? Seeing none, we'll open public testimony. All right. Those folks online, we'll go ahead and take those folks to call in order. We first have a Karen Malcolm Smith. If you want to state your name and any affiliation and plan for about 3 minutes for your testimony.
Yes, my name is Karen Malcolm Smith. I'm with the David Dillon Foundation, and I'm a self-funded advocate for the vast arena of issues surrounding stigma, including healthcare, education, and law enforcement. And I'm also a member of the Alaska Mental Health Advisory Board, but my testimony is strictly personal and does not represent the opinions of the board in any fashion. In June of 2017, just 1 month short of the Narcan accessibility to the public without a prescription, my 25-year-old son, Dylan Fuse, passed away from an overdose. And Dylan Fuse, his dependency followed a near-fatal ATV accident years before where he was very irresponsibly cut off without a taper after 3 months of morphine and oxycodone. And at 25 years old, he relapsed and had just returned from treatment when he passed away. The man that was with him called 911 immediately, and first responders were there right away. They did not carry Narcan, it was the police, and possibly could have saved him. And so, you know, part of this call, you've covered a lot of the statistics, DHSS, that I had to present, but I also do want to add that DHSS national statistics, the overdose rate is up close to 38%. Nationally, for the first, and I excuse me, but I don't know if it's first three quarters or all of 2020, but I think it's first three quarters. So I'm imagining that those results in Alaska when they come in are going to be pretty staggering. But I'm also want to say that in my work, I have come in close contact. I work with families now that are experiencing the loss that I've experience, and I represent a lot of, in this testimony, I represent other mothers who whose experienced first responders not carrying Narcan. Lisa Souter is one of them who runs Beans Cafe, and to this day, I mean, we don't know if my son could have been revived, if her son could have been revived, but just, you know, having accessibility, we strongly support SB 70, and we strongly encourage that in the future, you know, with all of the money that we spend in the opioid arena, money for COVID, MAT, which is medication-assisted treatment, treatment, detox, and all the healthcare costs from coping with PTSD for families, there's just so many costs, it's daunting, and the loss to community and the workforce as well. We really strongly urge, on top of SB 70, we're advocating for or encouraging the distribution or the mandatory equipping of first responders to carry Narcan, because I personally know probably about 8 people whose children's lives would have been saved. I have to say, I want to actually take this moment to say that so that he's not just a statistic, but that my son Dylan was a really incredible, stellar human being and citizen. He was a boxer and athlete and had this intense passion for music and songwriting and history, and a really a strong advocate for the suffering and the underdog. He had a warrior's heart, and I hope, you know, not only do I encourage a continuance of this distribution of, by DHSS, but I also battle for the mandatory equipping of all first responders, including police, and our ability to educate and to administer double doses, triple doses, if necessary, because fentanyl may require that. And I don't personally call it...
And Karen, if you could wrap up your comments, your time is up for testimony.
Okay, I will wrap it up. I just want to say that fentanyl is one of the major... causes of overdoses this past year, and I hope that we can eventually equip them to give extra doses to people that call 911. Thank you. Right,
thank you. Next, for public testimony, we have Ms. Katie Botts. If Katie, if you want to plan about 3 minutes for your testimony, you may begin when you're ready. Put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members of the Senate Health and Social Services. My name is Katie Boat, and I am from Juneau, Alaska, speaking on behalf of myself. I remember when the bill was in the state legislature regarding Narcan, because as soon as I looked at this bill and started listening to this committee, immediately, I remembered myself sitting in one of those rooms testifying for Narcan to save lives. I lost a friend back in the day, I believe it was 2017, 2016, somewhere around there, due to opioid overdose. And he hit it extremely well. I worked with him every day. I hang out with him in the evenings, on weekends. And I didn't know that he was, you know, doing drugs or anything. But when he went missing for 3 to 4 days in a row, it started to spark high concerns. And especially just after our birthdays, we were just like 2 days apart. And I remember the day in between our birthdays, the last time that I spent time with him. So it was very important for me to try to get this Narcan out and about in the hand of healthcare providers, because that's what it was for. It was for the police department and our healthcare providers to have on hand to be able to help in case of an opioid overdose. It's really discouraging to hear when I hear cases of them not having it on their hands to be able to save a person's life, because that was the whole intent of that bill. So I ask in respect that you make it mandatory for the healthcare providers and police officers to have a Narcan on hand. And I understand that financial is extremely tough this time of year, especially now. So maybe have like another branch somewhere. Maybe the people could help pay for the Narcan. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, seeing no one else online, we're going to close public testimony. there any other questions for the bill sponsors at this time? Senator Reinbold?
Is actually, I don't know if this is coloring out of the lines, but if Ms. Malcolm is still on, I wanted to make a comment to her, if only with your permission, Mr. Chairman.
Make a comment.
Is she still online?
I don't know.
Is she gone? Oh, she's still there. Okay. Well, I would like to just make a comment. First of all, I wanted to say thank you for your testimony. Thank you for serving on the Mental Health Trust Authority. I wanted to say I'm so sorry for your loss. It just didn't feel right to not say sorry. That has got to be huge. It sounds like you had a significant misfortune with the ATV accident and then an injustice when they cut him off from using these opioids. And I think that's a serious issue. You caught my attention completely there. And I wonder how many of these cases, I know there's a lot of opioid use with sexual assault, domestic violence use, you know, they're just trying to escape their pain. But this is another real issue when someone gets an injury, like a ski injury or something that is so common in Alaska, or an ATV injury, to go on opioids and then to be cut off, that can really create problems. So first of all, I want to say thank you for bringing that. That was a piece of the puzzle that I actually needed to hear. And I wanted to tell you thank you for turning your sorrow into advocacy for others and helping others. And where my question is, and you don't have to answer now because I know public testimony is over, but if you wouldn't mind sending numbers to the chairman in regards to what numbers you do have that I've asked everybody else in regards to overdoses or the use of Narcan or any of the impacts in regards to what's happened since March in particular on Alaskans. I'm just trying to let Alaskans know that we're hearing them, we listen to them, and we're trying to make a difference. So if you do have any statistics in regards to that, just so we can prevent this, this hardship on Alaskans from happening again, it would be really, really appreciated to get those statistics since I'm having a tough time getting them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll just make some closing comments to Senate Bill 70. We heard the committee's concerns. We will make an amendment to leave the report in. We'll take that out and present a CS to the committee our next hearing. And we will also ask for amendments for Senate Bill 65. For Senate Bill 65, if you have amendments, please let our office know so we can try to get those done and scheduled and by close of business on Wednesday. If you file them, please let us know that you're filing amendments so we know where to for the schedule for our upcoming meeting. If they're not due or if they're not ready by that, so we can plan accordingly for our best utilization of our time. With that, are there any other closing comments for today? Sina, I just want to thank everyone for attending. We are adjourned at 2:50 p.m.